America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin, along with John Crossett. And John, today we're going to be looking at a topic that clearly is on the minds of the foreign policy experts across the country and across the globe. And that is, how does the international community deal with the country of Iran? And one of the concerns, of course, is that Iran has a lot of proxies in the Middle East. But then again, we see that there are counterpoints to Iran in the Middle East, like Saudi Arabia. We haven't been too happy with them either. So, John, I don't know whether you can find that ally in the Middle East other than Israel that America tends to believe is reliable.
Well, I don't know. We don't really have, I don't believe we have a good name in the Middle East. I mean, a lot of these countries there, we go in there to get the oil, and we really don't treat the people or the governments, you know, very well. I mean, it's basically, you know, it's about the oil, and that's what it seems like it's always been with them.
Well, historically, I think less so today because of our own reserves. But having said that, with Iran, we like to say that they are a real bad actor and that they're causing a lot of foment beyond their desire to have a nuclear program. But I think the question, John, that we try to answer in this podcast is, well, are they really that bad? I mean, if you go back over the history, and you know it, John, we installed the Shah after we, well, deposed a democratically elected government. So our hands have not been the cleanest. So the question is, in this book about retargeting Iran, is that a good strategy, or should we try to work with them?
Well, it seems like these strategies always backfire. So we're trying it in Venezuela because they have a lot of oil. I mean, it seems like everywhere we go in and we do these strategies where we put the guy in that works for us, you know, it just never seems to work out, and we always end up the bad guy.
And we also end up with regimes that are really hostile and inimical to American interests, as we have since, what, 1979 in Iran. Of course, then we negotiated that nuclear deal, not only the United States, John, but a lot of our partners around the world, the JCPOA, as it's called. And then we backed out of that under the Trump administration. And the Biden administration doesn't seem terribly interested in rushing headlong back into that agreement. But I do wonder what kind of position and what kind of stance the new administration is going to take toward Iran.
Well, we got a problem with Iran. Now, we've had these agreements, but then, you know, they slowly but surely break them. It leaks out that they're doing this or doing that. At least that's what we hear in our news. So, you know, the agreement is only as good as, you know, the word of the people who are making it. Iran hasn't been typically good at that.
Well, I've got to tell you that you're going to be hearing from the editor of this book, Retargeting Iran, and he's got a lot of scholars who've contributed to it. And, John, I think his take on this is that as it relates to this particular agreement and the limitations of the agreement, because it wasn't meant to deal with other concerns that many of the countries, including the U.S., have about Iran, but that they actually were holding to it and that the accountability provisions were pretty severe. So why don't we dig into this with someone who really understands this? His name is David Barsamian. And again, he has coordinated the efforts of a lot of scholars as they've all contributed to the book, Retargeting Iran, today on America Trends. With me on the line, David Barsamian, and he has really compiled a remarkable book called Retargeting Iran with many fascinating contributors in a Q&A fashion, where he is able to elicit what the current state of affairs is between the United States and Iran. And David, take us back to 2007, a previous book called Targeting Iran. What's changed in those intervening years?
More and more hostility, largely generated from Washington toward Tehran and the government there. Iran was being threatened with war by the Bush administration, that's George W. Bush, who labeled that country part of the Axis of Evil. This came as a great shock to the Iranian people and the Iranian government when he did that, because it was fast on the heels of a remarkable cooperation between the United States and Iran in driving the Taliban from power in Kabul, Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a neighboring country of Iran's. The Taliban are notoriously sectarian. Now, that is to say, they loathe and despise Shia Muslims. Mm-hmm. Iran is overwhelmingly a Shia country. So that Bush took that step, very radical step, in labeling Iran as part of the Axis of Evil, really undercut the possibility of any kind of rapprochement. And then there was, you know, a lot of saber rattling, which is par for the course. It's going on once again today. And in the remaining, you know, days of this regime in Washington, there is always the threat of a precipitous military action in order to go out in a blaze of glory. So, the relationship is complicated. It goes back to, 1953, when a democratically popular and elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh was overthrown by the CIA, brought the Shah back into power, where he stayed for 26 years, committed enormous human rights violations. But for the U.S., he was a cash cow for military contracts, hundreds of millions of dollars. This is in the 60s and 70s, toward buying more and more weapons from Raytheon and Boeing and Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin and all the rest of the military-industrial complex. So the Shah was a key ally of the U.S., and when he was overthrown, that was a huge blow to the United States, to its hegemony in the Middle East. Iran, along with Israel and to some extent Turkey and Pakistan, were kind of the linchpin for U.S. policy in the region. They were, as Nixon's defense secretary called them, local cops on the beat. So if there was any, left-wing uprising or revolution, they could and would be deployed. If things got really serious, then Washington would step in directly. So that's kind of the background, and retargeting Iran is an update. I'm sorry I had to, do such a book, but it's absolutely necessary. Iran, with 80 million people, is a very important country in the Middle East. It has an incredibly rich cultural history of several thousands of years. And I think one of the things that irritates Iranians, and I've been there multiple times, and I have contacts there, is the lack of respect and dignity that's extended from Washington toward Iran and its people and culture. The U.S. is very dismissive and arrogant in its relations in general with other countries, but with Iran in particular, because of the overthrow of the Shah and the fact that, Washington really has never accepted the Islamic Revolution.
Well, help us to understand, because it's a very complex country. I mean, it's a country that does have this incredibly long tradition, long civilization. They don't seem to be the most warlike by any means. In fact, the Iran-Iraq war was started by Iraq. That turned out to be a stalemate. They have created and fomented some, guerrilla activity, let's say, in the Middle East, but explain that to us. But we have used that in many ways as a pretense for wanting to take pretty dramatic actions against them. Just explain, because they are the dominant Shia nation in the world, not only in the Middle East, and put that in contradistinction to the Sunni nations surrounding them.
Well, Shia Islam developed in the 7th and 8th centuries after Christ. It largely focuses and venerates on the person of Ali, A-L-I. And he and his offspring were part of the succession of Shia imams that Shia people venerate and honor and adore. As you said, Iran, with its 80 million people, is the largest Shia country in the world. And it's followed, incidentally, by its neighbor, Iraq. Also, there are large Shia populations in Lebanon, almost 40-45% of the population there, in Pakistan, and in Afghanistan as well. But the Shia Muslims are a minority in the world of Islam. Of the 1.3 billion Muslims in the world, about 15, maybe 18% are Shia. The rest are, as you noted, Sunni. And Saudi Arabia is the leading Sunni state. It's also the home of the most important shrines in Sunni Islam. And that is part of the rationale for the hostility between Iran, a Shia country, and Saudi Arabia and the other monarchies, which are also all Sunni. The U.S. has sought to control the region through divide and rule. Iran is completely surrounded by U.S. military bases. I ask people, let's say, your listeners, if Iran or some other country had naval armadas in the Gulf Coast, off the coast of New York, or Seattle, San Francisco, and had military troops in all over its borders, what the response would be. We know the answer to that. There would be an incredibly rapid and lethal reaction coming from Washington. And that's the situation that Iran finds itself in. It is surrounded by U.S. military bases and other hostile countries as well. Saudi Arabia wants to be the dominant power in the region. Iran, as you mentioned, also has surrogates, which is quite understandable. And they also have, believe it or not, national interests in the region. The U.S. always says it determines what its national interest is. Well, other countries also have national interests, and Iran does not want to be threatened by intolerant sectarian formations such as parts of the Sunni states are represent, that is to say, specifically Saudi Arabia. So Iran has allies in Iraq. Iran has allies in Libya, in Lebanon and in Syria as well. And this is quite understandable.
But David, let me ask you, how have they become villainized to the degree that they have, given that Saudi Arabia was definitely involved in 9/11, and yet we've maintained a relationship that has been considered almost in lockstep over the years with Saudi Arabia? And then we'll get into the nuclear deal, of course, which is a key centerpiece to all that's going on today as it relates to the U.S. and Iran. But just help us understand, how did it get to this point? Was it all back to 1979 and the hostage taking, and we just really haven't moved from that point?
That certainly has jaundiced the relationship between the two countries. The U.S. has never forgiven Iran for overthrowing the Shah. So that's at a, you know, is a core issue. But let's do a little historical review, and the media is notorious for not giving context and history and background. Mm-hmm. But let's go back to 1945, the end of World War II. Roosevelt is flying home. He had just been to the Yalta Conference with Stalin and Churchill. He's flying home to the United States. He's just a couple of months short of his death, actually. This is February 1945. But he makes a crucial stop on his way home. He met on a cruiser, a U.S. cruiser called the Quincy, in the Suez Canal. He met with Ibn Saud, then the king of Saudi Arabia. And that's where a pivotal agreement was reached between the United States and Saudi Arabia, which continues until this day. And what was the agreement that Roosevelt agreed to with Ibn Saud? That U.S. oil corporations would have exclusive access to Saudi oil fields. That's the central part of that agreement. And for that access, the U.S. would guarantee the protection and security of the Saud monarchy. So that you know, sort of explains this bizarre relationship, because, as you said, I mean, Saudi Arabia is itself, you know, a major violator of human rights. And this is not to, you know, downplay the Iranian government. I'm no fan of the government in Iran, which is homophobic, which is misogynistic, which is patriarchal, which, you know, has committed enormous human rights violations. So, you know, let's be clear about that. But Saudi Arabia, you know, sometimes I make this joke, Larry, that if an Iranian, if a Saudi woman goes to sleep tonight in Riyadh or Jeddah in Saudi Arabia and wakes up tomorrow morning in Iran, she thinks she might be in heaven. That's how advanced Iranian women are compared to Saudi Arabia, for example. So when I was in Iran, you know, you meet doctors, lawyers, architects, dentists, you know, professional women who are very well educated. Now, I have to point out, they don't have political power. None of the major ministries is headed by a woman in Iran.
David, in the book, of course, you remind us that the people of Iran, first of all, they're young, they're educated. Many look to the West culturally. They find us to be fascinating. They still like the United States in many ways. And we don't understand their various government structures. We don't understand how they have this supreme leader, the Ayatollah, and yet they have these more moderate factions who become president over time, like Rouhani. We just don't quite understand how the system works over there.
Yes, it's a very unusual and singular system of governance. There is the Ayatollah. Initially it was Khomeini, and now it's Khamenei. He has ultimate say-so. But there's a parallel structure, and that is a parliament. They call it the assembly, and a president who is elected, and a foreign minister, in this case, someone who was actually educated in Denver, Mohammad Javad Zarif, a very scholarly and thoughtful diplomat, someone that Kerry negotiated the deal, the Iran deal, a few years ago that Trump abandoned in May of 2018. So there's the religious, Iran is a theocratic state. It is it defines itself by Shia Islam. And the Ayatollah has ultimate authority. But as I said, there's a parallel governing structure of members of parliament. There are elections. People are appointed. There are ministries. So in that way, it's, as I said, quite singular and unusual.
But the final arbiter, I mean, if there is a disagreement between, let's say, those who are more of a civilian government versus a religious, you know, government, and you've got the military that has to weigh in on certain things, it's going to redound to the benefit, I would imagine, of the Ayatollah in any major dispute.
That's correct. There's an organization called the Revolutionary Guards. I talk about it in the book. It's described.
Yeah.
This is kind of a personal army of the Ayatollah, because when the Shah was overthrown in 1979, they couldn't trust the existing military structure in Iran, which had its loyalty to the Shah. So the generals, the colonels, the majors, all the high-ranking officers were beholden to the Shah. And so Khomeini, who was leading the government then, set up these Revolutionary Guards, which is kind of like a private army that, incidentally, not only is a military formation, but is a huge economic power. One of the things in the Middle East, and also in Pakistan, in Turkey, in other countries, in Iraq, the military has extra military abilities. That is to say, it owns real estate, it owns factories, it owns housing developments. And so it's much more than simply a military formation.
The book is called Retargeting Iran. David Barsamian is with us, and he's had many other contributors to this book, and he can describe who they are briefly as we move along. But I want to keep going with the story of Iran. One of the pieces that we have not brought into this puzzle is Israel and its relationship with Iran and its importance in the development of American foreign policy in relation to Iran. You say in the book, or one of the scholars that you brought forward, that it was really Benjamin Netanyahu who in many ways is responsible for the deal, but not perhaps the nuclear deal in the way that many might imagine.
That's right. Israel has had a very significant role in the formulation of U.S. policy in the Middle East, and specifically toward Iran. I don't think I'm saying anything controversial here. Israelis would be the first to point out that they want to play a dominant or at least an influential role in how U.S. policy is formulated. I mean, Israel is the center focus of U.S. Foreign policy. It commands billions of dollars in aid from Washington. Much of it is military aid, incidentally. It has nuclear weapons. This is well known. It never signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And Washington has been playing along with this little game that Israel does not have nukes, but it does have nukes. Iran has been accused of developing something that it doesn't have those weapons right now. Could they develop them? Possibly. If they're being threatened with annihilation and extinction, they would have no choice but to defend themselves. And I think we should, be clear about that. And Israel has been the, major formulating force of U.S. foreign policy in the region, and it has defined Iran as an existential threat to its existence. Now, Iran, not to its credit, has these little, as I call them, they're like theater, street theater.
Well, death to America, death to
Israel.
What does that mean? I mean, you say that, it's all part of their theater, as you say. But what is it meant to be taken seriously, literally, or not?
You can understand why Israeli Jews with the history of the Jewish people would feel uncomfortable with, anyone or any government, saying things like death to Israel. But, this is not a really, it's a rhetorical strategy to say, here we use this word that's so prevalent in the U.S., it's to satisfy and placate the base in Iran. It's to make them feel good that, they're burning American flags and Israeli flags. But this has very little to do with actual Iranian policy, which has been have been moving toward a rapprochement with Washington, and that was exemplified by the signing of the so-called Iran deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which was agreed to in 2015, in the summer of 2015. It took effect on January 1st, 2016, and it wasn't just Iran and the United States that signed this agreement. It was the entire permanent members of the Security Council, plus Germany, plus the European Union. And it went into effect, and it allowed for UN inspectors through the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is based in Vienna, to go to Iran and to examine exactly what they were doing. And you know what? As a result of what is called the most robust verification regime in history, Iran emerged with a clean bill of health. It was not developing nuclear weapons.
And so I found it interesting, and perhaps many have forgotten, that in developing this deal, there were scientists leading the various delegations. And the science of the deal is, in the book at least, it's said to be spot on. It's really the politics of the deal that has gotten so much attention. And obviously Donald Trump making it a centerpiece of his campaign in 2016. And he did get out of the deal. We're out of the deal. The Europeans, they're still in the deal. We've locked back sanctions on Iran. Tell us what the implications of that are now, today, as we sit here talking about this.
Ordinary people in Iran are suffering. Ordinary people are dying. We are in a global pandemic. Iran, because of sanctions, cannot import medical equipment such as ventilators, medicine, and other things that are required to fight this pandemic. So the ordinary Iranian is suffering tremendously. It's not hurting the leadership, which is, you know, doing just fine, as most elites in countries manage to find ways to protect their interests. It's the ordinary people that are suffering under these really draconian sanctions. There's no other word, there's no other adjective that comes to mind. They're extremely harsh and severe, and they're designed to specifically hurt people. Rhetoric aside, the pompous Pompeo, who's one of the worst secretaries of state in U.S. history, and I know the bar is really low when I say that, he has, openly almost laughed when he said, we're really sticking it to him. They're feeling the pinch, like this is something that, he's proud of, that people are dying during the pandemic because we won't allow medicines to get to people who need it. So it's a very immoral policy, in my view. We should be reaching out to Iran. We're all in this together in terms of fighting the pandemic. You alluded earlier to the fact that the United States is very popular in Iran. I've noticed this. A lot of Iranians speak American English. They love the music. They watch, the movies and the DVDs and, the Netflix and Showtime and Prime and all the rest. It's often said that after Israel, the country in the Middle East that the United States is most liked by is Iran. And I think that's correct. If you compare.
Do you think that the Biden administration will go back into the JCPOA, the nuclear deal? How difficult will that be? Of course, the president that Joe Biden worked for expended a lot of political capital on it, and he did accept Iran's red line that they could have a nuclear enrichment program on their soil. This made the deal possible. So what do you think, what kind of ground might we go back over that has already been gone over back when Barack Obama and his administration did put this deal together?
Well, Biden has, promised to renegotiate the deal. Now, it's not clear what is meant by renegotiation. Some people who are very hostile toward Iran have said that, you know, we cannot replicate the previous agreement. It has to be more stringent. It has to be much more focused and much more punitive. And this will make it very difficult for Iran to sign a new agreement if the U.S. changes, you know, its conditions. Now, this is something that is characteristic of not just U.S. foreign policy, but all imperial states constantly move the goalposts. So let's say, you know, we're playing a game on the 50-yard line, your team and my team, and all of a sudden I'm on the 1-yard line. I've moved the goalposts there, and I've changed the conditions of the game. And this creates an enormous amount of hostility toward the United States in that it doesn't keep its agreements. It doesn't keep its word. It changes its conditions that it had originally agreed to. And so that, I'm a little bit leery. I want there to be a peace between the two countries. I think it's absolutely essential. We should try and distance ourselves a little bit, at least, from Tel Aviv and its bellicose policies in the Middle East. And as I mentioned, it has not just nuclear weapons. It has the ballistic missiles to deliver those weapons. It has the second or third most powerful air force in the world. It is, you know, state-of-the-art military, and including cyber warfare as well as drone warfare, which was deployed by the Azeri Turks against the Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh. Israel sold Azerbaijan lots of these very high-tech lethal drones that really were a decisive factor in that war, which Armenia lost. JCPOA, the Iran deal, was successful. It was working, and we need to get back to the negotiating table. We need to sit down with our adversaries. It's easy to sit down with your friends, right? It's much harder to sit down with mutual respect and dignity to have a conversation.
How much of the agreement are they still holding to? Because the Europeans are still in the deal, of course, there are these limits on oil in terms of what they can sell where. Though I think the Europeans, are they still buying their oil? I mean, that's got to be a very important consideration. So how much pressure, because Joe Biden wants to reconnect with our allies, and of course he's got competing interests among our allies, but the European Union in all of this, what kind of pressure do you see them putting on him to get back in this deal?
The Europeans have clearly articulated their concerns about the current bellicose stance that Washington has adopted toward Iran. China is the largest purchaser of Iranian oil, followed by our NATO ally, Turkey, by the way. The European Union, because of the stringent sanctions that Washington has levied against anyone dealing with Iran, you know, China is powerful enough just to thumb its nose at Washington. We'll buy oil from whoever we want to, and they are doing it. Turkey, the same thing. But the Europeans have gone along with the embargo, but they want that to change. Iran is, you know, again, has had longstanding relationships and allies in Europe, and I'm sure wants to revive the friendship it had that had existed prior to this extremely hostile regime in Washington vis-a-vis Iran.
Since we pulled out, it's been reported that Iran is, again, months away from making a bomb or having the capacity to do that. I'm just wondering, what are the pressures internally within Iran? Because you talk about the people suffering so much, and we know they have such a large cohort of young people, well-educated. And we know we've seen people in the streets back about 10 years ago, and we thought that might be a turning point in the way that the country governs itself. Where do you see Iran going politically in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, there are internal tensions in the country, as there are in any country. We have to mention the United States with the deep divisions that exist today. So in Iran, you have, you know, what's called a moderate faction, right? That this would be represented by the current president, Rouhani, a previous president, Khatami, but not by Ahmadinejad, who was a bit to the right of both of those two leaders. So you have moderates that would like a deal with the United States, that would like to live in peace and harmony in the region and not be threatened by Sunni fanatics on their borders like the Taliban in Afghanistan and ISIS in Iraq and Syria. That's one of the reasons Iran has organized and supported military formations in these countries, is for their own self-defense. You know, if they're allowed to grow and develop, Iran would directly be affected. I remember when I was there a couple of years ago, a bus was blown up, killing 25 or 30 people by a group that was hiding in Pakistan. And they crossed the border into Iran and blew up this bus. And there have been many other instances of terrorist attacks against Shias, in particular Shia shrines in Iran and in Syria and in Iraq as well. Now, so I mentioned the moderates. You know, they would like to have some kind of deal with the U.S. that's based on mutual respect and dignity. And then you have the what are called hardliners. Now, I'm not terribly comfortable with these terms. I use them, but let's just be cautious about, you know, calling someone a moderate or a hardliner, you know. Hardliner is extremely pejorative. But there is a group that wants to confront the U.S. and Israel in a very aggressive manner. And they may be formulating around the Revolutionary Guards and the Ayatollah. So that would be, you know, these are the two major tensions that are pulling inside of Iran today. You know, I think ultimately the military there and the Ayatollahs will relinquish power. Nothing lasts forever. And I don't think the Islamic form of government that exists there now will last forever. But, you know, right now they're in the saddle. They do have power and they control the country. But this is not a permanent situation. You mentioned demonstrations in 2009. There were more demonstrations in 2017 and 18. And sporadic ones here and there. So there is internal opposition from a youth cohort that is very well educated, that, you know, it speaks several languages and, you know, wants to have a decent future that is not driven by patriarchy and theocracy and misogyny and homophobia.
If we were having this conversation 3-4 years down the road, do you think we would have seen a greater chance for rapprochement versus the real risk of a war, which a lot of people thought might be in play toward the end of the Trump administration? Do you think we're more likely to see one than the other, or are both perhaps options on the table that we can't dismiss regardless of the change in administrations here in the U.S.?
Well, I think there is a fundamental difference between the current regime in Washington with its, you know, deplorable Secretary of State and the orange-haired occupant of the oral orifice, as I call it. These are very dangerous men. They are extremely bellicose and warlike, and as I, you know, hinted at earlier, they may, you know, want to go out in a blaze of glory. And, you know, Iran is an easy target. You know, all you have to do is whip up a frenzy here in the United States, which the media largely join in, is, you know, wave the flag and say, you know, our brave men and women in uniform are in harm's way. Iran is threatening us, so we have to take decisive action to protect ourselves. It's self-defense. You know, we're the only country that attacks other countries and always calls it self-defense.
Yeah. Interactions with Iran in terms of the assassination of Soleimani and various types of interactions with ships and the like. So we have been on kind of a trigger's edge with Iran for some time. Do you think that going forward we'll start pulling back from some of those potential flashpoints?
I certainly hope so. You know, the current posture is not sustainable. And so, you know, I think we have to get back. We have to build bridges. We don't want to, you know, they talk a lot about infrastructure. Your U.S. infrastructure is deteriorating, and it's certainly true. But we need not to build walls between countries and peoples. We need to build bridges. And the Iranian people, a large number of Iranian people, are ready, willing, and able to create a situation where it can have peaceful and friendly relations with the United States.
David Barsamian, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Do you want to say anything about the contributors to this book? Because people do know these names, like Noam Chomsky. But do you want to say any more about these contributors? It's a wonderfully easy book to read in a Q&A fashion. It really is.
Thanks very much. Yeah, of course, there's the legendary MIT professor Noam Chomsky. He's the only U.S. person in the book. The rest are all Iranians. Azadeh Moadani is a woman I've met. She's a feminist scholar based now in London. She couldn't continue to do work in Iran, and she has a very significant chapter in this book about women and women's rights and gender relations in Iran. Chita Parsi is Iranian, a great scholar, as is Nader Hashemi, who's actually born in Toronto of Iranian parents, now teaches at the University of Denver, not far from where I'm speaking to you. I'm in Boulder, Colorado. He has a great chapter. And then there's Ervant Abrahamyan, an Armenian-Iranian, lives in Brooklyn, has written with great authority on the Iranian revolution and Iranian history. He's probably the foremost scholar of 20th century and 21st century Iranian history. So it's a wonderful mix of voices. And one of the virtues of an interview book is you can kind of open it up at any page and find something, a nugget here and there, that is very useful. And so I'm worked really hard on editing it and to cut any fat, as it were, or things that were vague or opaque, and to just have core material and strip it down.
Yeah, it's very clear, very readable. And I thank you so much. David is the founder and director of Alternative Radio and, of course, the person who has put this book together, edited it with a great deal of care, and taken a lot of care in what he said today with us on America Trends. The book, again, Retargeting Iran. Thank you so much for being with us on America Trends.
Thank you for having me, Larry. And can I give my website?
Yeah, of course.
It's www, obviously, alternativeradio.org, alternativeradio.org. Thanks very much for your work.
My pleasure. Thank you, David.